Lecture 7, Spying of the European Great Powers.
The year is 1809, and it's a good time for a transatlantic spy panic, one that links events in France with events in the New World. In Guatemala City in 1809, in the Spanish Empire in the Americas, a barber is arrested. How dangerous could a barber be? But the authorities are convinced that he is a threat. The barber is a local, but the Spanish authorities conclude that he must be really a French spy, because he's been talking about revolutionary ideas. This is the dawn of the age of ideology, when the fervor that earlier had been given to religious belief now is increasingly transferred to the struggle for political order. At the same time, notice something else. There's a worldwide reach to the operations of the secret world. The very arrest of the barber in the Americas for propagating revolutionary ideas from France shows the worldwide connections that have been established. In this lecture, we'll turn to the rivalries of Europe's great powers in the 19th century and the role played by espionage and covert operations in this competition. The revolutionary French regime envisioned a radically different society, and secret services grew up in France to enforce these far-reaching demands. When Napoleon built a great empire, claiming that he was extending the gains of the French Revolution, this empire too required a clandestine intelligence service. And so too, after Napoleon's defeat, the restored monarchies of Europe sought security against internal revolutionary movements through secret policing and spies of their own. Secret police and censorship, as we've already seen in many prior lectures, were not new. Think of ancient Sparta, or Persia, the eyes and ears of the king, or Ivan the Terrible and his Oprichnina. What was new here was a far more organized and far more ambitious effort to engineer society, to keep it under surveillance, and through censorship, to direct its very thoughts and ideas. The French Revolution, which broke out in 1789, was a very different affair from the American struggle. It was more violent, it was more radical, and in many ways tragic. But those events, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, were linked, because the French kingdom's intervention in the American War for Independence, as well as structural problems within France, produced political crisis at home and precipitated the revolution in Paris. The French revolutionary slogan of liberty, equality, and fraternity indicated a new way of thinking about politics and what was legitimate rule. Now the patrie, the nation or the fatherland, was to be the holder of ultimate political power and legitimacy. And because power was to be placed where it belonged in the hands of the people, the new state could likewise make radical new demands on citizens. The revolutionary ideology commanded obedience and, very often, enthusiastic participation, indeed, ideological faith that could resemble the intensity of earlier religious belief of prior ages. The French uprising, moreover, became steadily more radical, and finally produced the Reign of Terror in 1793 to 1794. The king and the queen, the nobility, and soon even the lowliest in society were caught up and sent to the guillotine if suspected of treason against the Republic. A regime that was to be more democratic and humane instead produced spasms of revolutionary violence and repression. Many people elsewhere in Europe looked on with horror, especially aristocrats who sympathized with their fellow nobles in France and the turmoil they were undergoing. Networks were developed to smuggle endangered aristocrats out. Among those networks was a spy that we don't know much about. His name was Richebourg, called the shortest adult spy in history. He supposedly stood at only 23 inches tall and thus could pose as a child. And the story has it that he was able to pass through the barricades of French revolutionaries by being carried by a nurse, swaddled up as if he were a babe in arms. William Wickham, a British civil servant, was sent as an assistant to the British ambassador to Switzerland in 1794, and from there constructed a spy network that reached into France and intrigued with aristocrats to build an effective plot for the invasion of France and the overthrow of the French Revolution. It's this historical episode that forms the backdrop for one of the great novels of intrigue in the secret world, The Baroness Orsi's The Scarlet Pimpernel. It has been called the greatest adventure story ever published. The hero is a shadowy figure, a British aristocrat who saves countless French nobles from the guillotine under the very noses of the French officials. This British aristocrat smuggles himself into revolutionary France and out again with those whom he has saved. His identity is unknown, and he's called by a code name, which is his emblem as well, an inconspicuous red British flower, the Scarlet Pimpernel. He is surrounded by 19 dashing young followers, all of them British gentlemen of the most proper sort, and their prime motivation is perhaps not even so much political or nationalist, but the sport and the sheer fun of daring such a game. The book was published in 1905, so it was appeared long after the events of the French Revolution, but it was then tremendously influential in popular literature. In fact, The Scarlet Pimpernel is a model for the hero who's become a staple of thriller fiction, the hero who has a secret identity. This can include superheroes like Superman, as the mild-mannered Clark Kent, or the dashing and elegant style of this hero, the Scarlet Pimpernel, in some ways anticipates James Bond and his elegant lifestyle. Remarkably, its author was not English herself. She was from Hungary and only learned English as a girl of 15. She went on to write this suspense novel that's permeated with British nationalism. And so ironically, it's a Hungarian woman who produces a romantic idealization of the British gentleman. The hero, the Scarlet Pimpernel, Sir Percy Blakeney, is the very epitome of cool. He hides behind the demeanor of an upper-class twit, endless reserves of daring, humanity, and heroism. Returning to the real events of the French Revolution, after the turmoil of the Reign of Terror, many people were ready for a restoration of order in France. And that's what was promised by a self-made military hero, Napoleon Bonaparte, who became ruler of France as first consul in 1799, and then in an audacious act crowned himself Emperor of France in 1804 in the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. He went on to fight a series of wars in which he conquered much of Europe. To rule in France and in the greater empire he had carved out in Europe, Napoleon needed an intelligence network. And key figures in that network were Joseph Fouché and Karl Schulmeister. Let me discuss them in turn. Joseph Fouché had studied for the priesthood, but when the French Revolution came, he instead embarked on a wild political career, which took him all over the ideological landscape as he kept shifting his loyalties and demonstrated his fabulous flexibility and opportunism. Napoleon, recognizing his talents, made him Minister of Police. In his time in office, Fouché built up France's police state, and he reported to Napoleon nearly daily, making himself indispensable. Fouché's exhaustive reports included pretty much everything: what the current gossip was in society and in people's living rooms, how audiences were reacting to new plays, how the public reacted to news of Napoleon's constant stream of military victories, how they reacted to economic news, pretty much everything. Paradoxically, however, Napoleon was torn. He felt that he both needed Fouché and suspected him. Someone who amassed so much information, damaging information about the people of France, was surely amassing potentially dangerous information about Napoleon himself. And Napoleon could never quite decide whether to hire or fire Fouché. He fired him from his post in 1802, then brought him back as Minister of Police in 1804, and then finally dismissed him in 1810. I want to turn now to Napoleon's crucial military spy, Karl Schulmeister. Karl Schulmeister was born in the territory of Alsace in 1770. Alsace is the border region between French and German lands. Schulmeister became a famous smuggler and was a popular hero as a consequence in Alsace. In 1804, he had been recruited to help in the botched kidnapping of one of Napoleon's noble enemies. And thus he came to the attention of Napoleon himself. In 1805, when he was introduced to the emperor, Napoleon gave him a mission. Schulmeister was to infiltrate Austrian headquarters, pretending to be a Hungarian nobleman in exile. This, by the way, must have been quite an act of role-playing for an Alsatian smuggler to pass himself off as a Hungarian nobleman. Once he had been accepted into the Austrian circles, Schulmeister was actually made head of military intelligence for the Austrians. And as a result, when Napoleon clashed with Austria, the Austrian army was, probably not coincidentally, badly beaten by Napoleon at the battles of Ulm and Austerlitz. Schulmeister, however, eventually lost favor in Napoleon's court and retired to a lifestyle of a gentleman on the huge estate that he had bought for himself in Alsace. However, when the Austrians were chasing Napoleon after one of his rare defeats in 1813 to 1814, the Austrians did take time out to make a detour to Alsace and to actually destroy Schulmeister's estate in revenge. Schulmeister ended up with a tobacco shop in Alsace and Strasbourg, dying in poverty, but still a local celebrity. Even good intelligence finally was trumped by Napoleon's legendary outsize ambition. In the end, Napoleon overreached in two ways in his military campaigns, invading Spain in 1807 and Russia in 1812. In both cases, irregular warfare erupted, with guerrilla fighting taking place against the French invader. And the British were able, this would become a trademark strategy of theirs, were able to exploit and encourage this kind of warfare, especially in Spain. Arthur Wellesley, later Duke of Wellington, landed in Spain and fought running battles with the French using intelligence officers, called exploring officers, who mapped and gathered intelligence. The same commander, the Duke of Wellington, would ultimately defeat Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. The secret police forces of the Napoleonic age were also the inspiration for one of the greatest and most popular operas, Tosca, by Giacomo Puccini, which premiered in 1900 and even today is one of the most frequently staged operas. In it, the villain, Baron Scarpia, is the chief of police in Rome and has spies at work infiltrating revolutionary societies. This is further evidence of the cultural impact of espionage, in this case on music and opera. Before finishing with Napoleon, I'd like to take a moment to look at two French spy scares, one across the Atlantic Ocean and the second in England. The first case, which is the one that we opened this lecture with, shows how Central America, so far away from France, was still affected by the fears of Napoleonic espionage and subversion, especially in the territories of Guatemala in the Spanish Empire. In 1812, a panic arose over rumors that Guatemala was about to be attacked by 500 French soldiers dressed as priests. The local population was seized with fear, and the cry went up that it was necessary to defend religion, country, and crown against French revolutionary ideas and against Napoleon. Napoleon was even denounced in vivid language as the great horned serpent and the most cruel and abominable monster in nature. The spy panic had actually been building for years past and involved the suspicion that not only French soldiers were insinuating themselves into colonial society, but that in fact there were locals who sympathized with the French Revolution and Napoleon. The example we began with was that in 1809 of the arrest of Agustin Vilches, a barber in Guatemala City who was arrested for his so-called political blasphemies, for saying that the Spanish should be sent back to Spain and that Guatemala would be under French control soon. For his pains, he ended up being sent to Spain under arrest. Fears grew among colonial officials of a large network of French spies that they were sure were based in New Orleans, just waiting for orders to fan out across the Spanish colonial empire. The Catholic Church was enlisted to help prepare for the looming crisis. On Sundays, Catholic pastors read out descriptions to their flock of suspected spies and threatened to excommunicate those who did not turn over to the authorities any subversive publications pushing radical French ideas here in Guatemala. The threat of the spies was presented as one directed against Spanish political authority, Catholic religion, and Spanish culture. The colonial administration, however, inadvertently antagonized locals called Creoles, that is, people born in the Americas, not in Spain, by setting up special courts to deal with the crisis, sidelining local authorities. And this provoked resentment. Anyone claiming that there was any difference between Spaniards from Spain and Spanish-speaking Creoles could be prosecuted. The unplanned result of this repression was to actually provoke local unrest, without there needing to be any French agents or provocateurs even involved. The eventual paradoxical result would be a later full break with Spain and independence for Central American countries. The second case of a French spy scare is actually a very sad story, if true. Debate still continues about whether it's just a local legend or whether it's a true memory of an event that actually happened. The story is set in Hartlepool, on the coast of northeast England, around the time of the Napoleonic Wars, when there were great fears of a coming French invasion of the British Isles. As local fishermen looked on from the coast, a French battleship was wrecked during a storm, and all hands were drowned in that wreck, which washed ashore, except for one lone survivor, the ship's pet monkey. As the story goes, the British fishermen had never seen a Frenchman before, but they had been told that the French were demonic, subversive, and subhuman in their depravity. And so the fishermen assumed that the monkey was a Frenchman, because the monkey refused to answer their questions and he seemed not to speak English, but instead spoke a harsh language they did not understand. They concluded that he was a spy and sentenced him to death by hanging, a sad fate. Now, strictly speaking, the monkey should have been spared by the conventions of the day, because the monkey was actually dressed in a miniature French uniform to amuse his French shipmates on the ship that had been lost. Not being out of uniform, he should merely have been taken prisoner. I should add that if he had been a spy, this would have been a rare case of ape-int to add alongside hume-int and sig-int. Back in 2005, there was a lot of excitement at Hartlepool when a large bone had been found on the seashore, and people thought this was finally proof of the monkey's existence, but it appears instead to have come from a prehistoric deer. Residents of Hartlepool have a nickname in the larger region. They're called monkey hangers as a consequence of this unfortunate story. After the fall of Napoleon, the challenge for Europeans was somehow to set their continent back on an even keel after decades of unending warfare and unrest. At the Congress of Vienna in 1815, they sought to do just that. The statesmen of the great powers sought to restore order to Europe and to usher in a period of a long peace between the main countries of Europe that actually lasted until 1914 without a larger general war. The Congress of Vienna conferred under the leadership of Prince Clemens von Metternich, the coachman of Europe. His prescription was for a concert of Europe that would stamp out revolutionary ideas wherever they were to be found. This was princes and kings acting in concert with one another to crush revolution. Metternich's special loathing was for revolutionary nationalist secret societies, like the Italian nationalist Carbonari, or the Burschenschaften revolutionary nationalists in the German universities. Among this younger generation, especially among university students, a new romantic mood was circulating, which rebelled against the idea of a merely orderly restoration. Romanticism, as thus espoused, was both an artistic and philosophical and political movement. It was united by a sense of impatience, a love of extremes, a thirst for authenticity, and an emphasis on feeling, reacting against the sterile rationalism, as they called it, of the Enlightenment. This romanticism also coincided frequently with a new sense of nationalism, and especially a striving for liberation from older traditional empires. Metternich, however, would have none of this. At his insistence in 1819, the Carlsbad decrees were passed, banning student organizations, imposing close censorship on pamphlets and the periodical press, and setting up a special censorship investigation office in Mainz. I can assure you that due to the Carlsbad decrees, if we'd been in those times, this very lecture you are listening to now would probably have been shut down a few minutes in as soon as I mentioned revolution. There is a bizarre example that's worth noting of how spies and spy masters can have vastly flexible loyalties. And this is essentially the afterlife of Napoleon's feared spy master, Joseph Fouché. You'll remember that when we last saw him, he'd been fired by Napoleon in 1810. Again. When Napoleon was first defeated in 1814, he'd been sent into exile on the island of Elba. At that point, Fouché went over to the monarchist side and disavowed his earlier loyalty for Napoleon. But at the same time, he kept in touch with the exiled Napoleon. Napoleon then escaped from Elba and returned to France for the Hundred Days, his brief rampage before the final end of his reign. At that point, Fouché changed sides yet again and rejoined Napoleon again as his chief of police. After Napoleon was finally and definitively defeated at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, Fouché tried to change sides again. He tried to curry favor with the new regime by promising to help them hunt down Napoleon's earlier followers, of which he was one. This was finally too much for the French elite, and he was instead exiled from France. Fouché ended up dying in exile in Trieste. He had been racked with arthritis that was so bad that in the end, when he died, his undertakers were unable to straighten his body out to lie in the coffin. And thus, he was buried sitting up. This is perhaps appropriate for someone who had kept control of France while sitting at a desk due to his organizational and police powers to be buried in a sitting position. Of the European powers, the Russian Empire came to be the ultimate conservative authoritarian power. Indeed, it was called the policeman of Europe. This had everything to do with an attempted uprising in 1825, the so-called Decembrist Revolt, when young Russian romantic nationalist officers who wanted a more liberal regime had tried to rise up against the Tsarist regime. This 1825 revolt terrified the new Tsar Nicholas I. The experience of having his own personal rule challenged transformed him into what would be his nickname, the Iron Autocrat. Nicholas I reverted to a longer, earlier tradition of Russian secret police for internal control, dating back to Ivan the Terrible's founding of the Oprichnina in 1565, and then later continued by Peter the Great. In fact, Peter's secret police has been so secret that historians don't even really know when it was founded. On Nicholas's orders, a new organization was formed in 1826, the so-called Third Section. It was set up to combat subversive ideas and, this was a very poetic sort of formulation, to map the soul of Russian society by keeping close watch on its tendencies. The Third Section was small. It had a headquarters staff that started at 16 and then grew to 40 by the time Nicholas died in 1855. But the Third Section was very proud of an achievement. When the rest of Europe saw nationalist and liberal revolts in 1848, Russia did not. But in the longer term, there was an irony. The very harshness of Russian repression was breeding a new generation of radical revolutionaries who didn't want to compromise or reform the status quo, but overthrow it. In 1874, some of these so-called populist revolutionaries announced a holy pilgrimage to the people, which saw student radicals going out into the countryside to fire the peasantry with revolutionary ideas. This ended very badly because the peasants tended to arrest these suspicious-looking students and turn them over to the police. So many of the populists were disappointed by this failed venture that they turned to terrorism, especially in a group called the People's Will. In a spree of terror, they committed countless political murders, crowned finally with the assassination of Tsar Alexander in 1881, who was blown up with a hand grenade. Reacting to this crisis, a new secret police force was organized, actually starting in the year before the assassination of Tsar Alexander in 1880, called the Okhrana. It went into action on an international scale, and we'll talk more about them shortly. As we mentioned a moment before, exciting things had been happening in Europe in 1848, except in Russia and in England. Russia was too repressive, England not repressive enough to provoke revolution. In 1848, revolutions had swept other European countries, and it seemed that the monarchies throughout Europe teetered on collapse. The counter-revolutionary Metternich had to flee from Austria to exile. Kings had to promise constitutions and bow to liberal revolutionary demands for the rule of law. But at the end of the day, revolutionaries saw power slip away from them. And in Germany and Italy especially, nationalists were crushingly disappointed that national unification had also been missed. Those countries remained divided. Conservatives were able to regain control, but they afterwards were able to co-opt and use nationalism, especially the demand for German unity. The man who did this best was the so-called Iron Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck. As Chancellor of the North German state of Prussia, Bismarck fought a series of wars with Prussia's neighbors, Denmark, Austria, and France, and at the end, by 1871, had fused a united Germany around the hard core of the Prussian state. This was called the German Revolution, on a par with the French Revolution of 1789, and remade the European political map. An important and disturbing role in this process of German unification was played by a mysterious and distasteful person who became Bismarck's spy master, Wilhelm Karl Eduard Stieber. He was the Prussian director of police. Stieber was born in Merseburg in Prussian Saxony. He studied law in Berlin before becoming commissioner in the Berlin police force in 1844. Stieber apparently smoothed his way to his police career by denouncing his wife's uncle to the police and thus proved his fierce ruthlessness. In 1845, he went undercover to infiltrate socialists in Silesia. He was always assiduous in self-promotion, and in an example of this, during the Revolution of 1848, he claimed that he personally had rescued King Friedrich Wilhelm IV in Berlin during the riots there. He was made director of the Berlin police and traveled to London and Paris to infiltrate socialists and communists around Marx, producing intelligence that was later used in trials against international communists. When the new king of Prussia, Wilhelm I, came to the throne, Stieber's fortunes declined. Wilhelm I really disliked him, and thus Stieber was out of favor and out of his earlier job for a number of years. Most of this time, Stieber spent in Russia, working with the Russian secret police, the Third Section. This is a remarkable example of international cooperation among secret police. When Stieber met Bismarck, Bismarck saw him for a very effective man, and thus Stieber was invited back to Prussia, where a strange partnership emerged between him and Bismarck. Stieber traveled to Austria, collecting information about that state, posing as a peddler of religious items and also of pornography. He judged, I guess, that if you weren't interested in one, perhaps you were interested in the other. In the process of his travels through Austria in disguise, he gathered a huge amount of information which helped the Prussians in winning a crushing defeat of Austria in 1866. The characteristic aspect of his approach was to be exhaustive, incredibly detailed, almost microscopic in particulars. Then in 1868, Stieber did the same sort of investigation against France, including both military and non-military facts that he was collecting on things like public morale. He also established a network of sleeper agents in France, and thus, in 1871, in a war that lasted for only 6 weeks, France was decisively defeated, not through espionage alone, but it helped, and a brand new powerful German empire was announced in Versailles. Although Bismarck appreciated Stieber and called him by the fond nickname, "My King of Sleuthhounds," others hated him. Stieber, unlike the spymaster Sir Francis Walsingham of Queen Elizabeth, was in it for personal gain, which he achieved through blackmail on the side, sort of in parallel to his official activities. In Berlin, Stieber set up a notorious place called the Greenhouse. This was a house of ill repute where all kinds of decadent depravity were on offer to the elite. But once the elite had succumbed, he blackmailed those who indulged. And it's been suggested that this was motivated by Stieber's class anxieties, that Stieber hoped to be accepted into high society. As it turns out, blackmail was a very bad way to come to be accepted as a member of the elite. When Stieber finally died in 1882, his funeral was massively well attended. And you might have thought that it was for a man who was much admired and respected. In fact, many representatives of other countries had come to check up to see if Stieber was really dead or whether this was just a trick. What Stieber did leave behind was the ambition to craft a well-organized, incredibly detailed, systematic, effective espionage apparatus. And this would be the shape of things to come. Nothing succeeds like success, and others would seek to imitate this model. In our next lecture, we will cross the Atlantic again to observe the American struggle to improvise similarly effective spying and covert action in the bloody context of the American Civil War.